Can you just say your name and spell it for the one who's transcribing?
Sure, my name's Steve Rushton, a full name Stephen, S-T-E-P-H, middle name Peter, P-E-T-E-R, surname Rushton, R-U-S-H-T-O-N.
And what's your date of birth?
7th of November 1959.
And so we're going back to the period between 1984 and 1994. And was you one of the Acme artists, or did you live in another house in that area?
No, I was one of the Acme artists.
And whereabouts did you live in the Leytonstone area?
I lived in Fillybrook Road at number 157.
And when did you actually move in?
Good question. What happened was, as a preamble, after studying at Kingston Polytechnic, I studied teacher training for a year in Liverpool, and then moved down to Leyton, and then got a flat with a partner in Hackney, which I spent about a year or 2 years in. So it means that probably around 1986-87 I moved to Leytonstone. So I don't know whether that was one of the earliest. I don't think it was, anyway.
Okay, so you moved in 1986 or 7.
Yeah.
And when did you actually move out of the area?
I think that was 1993. 1994.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you was basically there right till the end?
Yeah.
Nearly that?
Yeah.
Right till the end, you think?
Or? Well, it depends how you define the end, really, because there are people still living there now. It definitely seemed like an end of something when I left, although it's a long story.
Good. Okay, so what would be really nice if you could start by describing your first impressions of the house.
Yeah.
So obviously you went to look at the house and then decided to take the house. So what was that like, your first impression?
Well, the process was interesting because both me and Catherine Baker, who was my partner at the time, went for an interview with Acme, and that seemed to go well. And then after a while, we got offered a place in Colville Road. And we went round to see it and hummed and hawed, and then eventually said no to it. I had a drum kit and lots of stuff that, because it was quite a small house in Colville Road, would have been a real cramp to fit in. So it was a bit of a risk saying no, because we worried that, you know, and there was always that kind of a desire on the part of Acme for people to move into the first house that they're given. So anyway, we said no, and then a couple of days later we got given a bigger place, or asked to go and see a bigger place. We didn't know it was how big it was, but it was bigger. So we went to see it one evening. Think it was in the summer, but it was kind of dark when we got there, so we mustn't have been able to get there till about 8 or something. And my first impression was that it was a terraced mansion. I mean, compared to Culver Road, it was massive. The rooms were big. The state of the place was, well, there was work to be done, but it wasn't that bad. All of the fireplaces were knocked out, which I later found out was not the case with all the houses, and people who became friends of mine actually started making a feature and building things around the in-situ fireplaces. But the floors were reasonably okay, the toilets were not smashed in. I think they chucked some rubble down it, but I know, again, from later on, that some were smashed in. So the size of it felt refreshing, and the fact that we'd heard stories about how bad things could be. It didn't seem too bad. We had a slight altercation with the next door neighbour. We got to know him and his family. They were he was a builder and ran a, he was self-employed as a builder. Mr. Connolly, I've forgotten what his name is, but he leaned over the door as we were either coming out or coming in and started ranting on about squatters and how, you know, he wasn't going to stand for any messing. And he's the sort of guy that if you stand up to him, then the next day he'll say, oh, you know, how are welcome, etc., etc. I kind of grew up with men from Liverpool a bit like that. So he was okay, but it was an interesting first impression anyway. And there was space, and that was great.
Can you remember how many rooms were in that house?
Yeah, you went in through the front door, and then you turned right, and there was a front room, which is a living room, and then there was a... It wasn't an arch, but obviously the front room and the back room had been knocked through, so it was like a large room with a kind of rectangular opening between the two, which made things problematic for the cold in the winter because it was difficult to heat. So there was a one big room that used to be two rooms, and then there was a very small kitchen behind the background back room. I think perhaps some people had used the back room as the kitchen, but we, it was a very small room which could have been a pantry or whatever. Anyway, used that as the kitchen. And if you continued straight down the hall, then there was a very big back room. So you could say there were two really big rooms on the ground floor. And then you went up the stairs and there was a very, very big front room, which certainly was later used as a studio. And then there were three other bedrooms on top of that, one of which was very much a box room, and the other two were reasonably sized bedrooms. There was an attic, but there was no floorboards down, so just had to go up there frequently to put fresh buckets under the leak in the roof.
So, like, it sounded almost like it was the size of the Colville Road houses, but, like, did it have, like, a big hallway and so forth?
Yeah, it was much bigger than the Colville Road houses. The hallway was quite big. We later... adopted a cat who used to run up and down it and could get to quite a speed, so tells you how long they were. And the rooms were bigger than the Colville Road rooms. It was a spacious place.
So, in terms of your house, where did you organise everything? Like, where did you have your studio and your... You mentioned your... musical equipment, your drums and so forth. Like, where did that all go? How did you organise it?
Well, we took our time because although it wasn't in that bad nick, what we decided to do is the top front room we decorated first and cleaned first. And we were doing that while we were living in Hackney. And then once that was habitable, had a friend with a van, we moved everything into that room, including a bed. And then from then on started tidying up, sanding floors in the other rooms. And through that process started making decisions about where things were going to be. I took the studio, the big room on the top floor, the first floor. And Kath took as her studio the big back room on the ground floor. The living room and back room were used as a communal area, and there was the kitchen at the back, which was quite small. And then for the three bedrooms, we had together the back bedroom for ourselves, and then we needed to get a lodger in to pay the rent because neither of us was doing hardly any work. So the it was a kind of middle bedroom, not the box bedroom, but the middle bedroom was to be the lodger's bedroom. and so that's the way we were planning it. I don't think at the beginning we planned on a lodger, but we started working out expenses and realised that, you know, in order to survive, we needed to do this. So that's the way it was laid out.
So was the lodger an artist as well?
No, the lodger thing was quite interesting because I had a lot of principles at the time. Not to say I don't have any principles now, but this whole idea of getting a lodger was an odd thing. And I think one of my closest friends I met walking to the corner shop at the top of Fillybrook Road, and he was an Acme artist as well, John Bissett. And one of the first things I said to him was, I hear you have a lodger, you know, what do you charge and all this sort of thing. Because I didn't want to charge. It was difficult to know what to charge. Anyway, we ended up advertising time out and just saying cheap rent, no Tories, something like that. And then got about 10 people coming, and we had to interview, and actually met some really nice people that we became close friends with. But the first person that became the lodger was, I think she was an accountant or something, a Canadian from Toronto. She was just doing a menial job, and she didn't stay that long because she was very much a party animal and so was out in Camden all the time, and after about a year the trek from Leytonstone to Camden became a bit too much for her. But she was splitting up with her boyfriend at the time, so she needed to get out, so she came and lived with us and brought her cat with her, who was, I think, perhaps a last ditch attempt to keep the relationship together that didn't quite work, so the cat came. And then when she left, finally, to move back to Camden, she left the cat with us.
So can you remember what your rent was at the time?
I can't, no. I can't. I know it was more than Colville Road. And I know we were very upfront with the lodge to say, look, this is what we're paying, you know, your wage, you know, we think this is a fair rent, are you okay with this? And it was, I think, you know, from what lodge of sayings, we're at half the price than they pay elsewhere, so that's why we got a lot of
I think Colville Road was about £13 a week.
£13 a week. Wow, so that would be 26, that'd be something like £50-60
a month.
I think at beginning ours was something like 95. That number rings a bell. And then it went, I think it went up to 125 or something like that. So I think we charged the lodger something like £50 a month or something like that. And then me and Kath would have paid. It may have gone up to, yeah, something like that. Anyway, so, some time ago.
When you sort of decorated your house, can you say something about, like, the decor? Because you mentioned the fireplaces had been pulled out. How did you deal with that, for example?
A number of the windows were boarded up, so I just used it was kind of plywood boarding, I don't know what you call it. Anyway, I started cutting that up and just filled the fireplace with that, creating a kind of simple box thing that would block them up, and put an air grill in them as well. That I think we did with pretty much every fireplace, apart from the fireplace in the very tiny room, which was left because it was just a tiny fireplace. It's obviously not worth ripping out. It's interesting thinking about that, because although they took the fireplaces and got friendly with the builder next door, as I was leaving that house so many years later, he said, the thing that you have got, which people didn't rip off, is we had crown chimney stacks, which are apparently very valuable. So I was slightly drunk on, I think, the second to last day before I left, and he gave me these ladders, and I climbed halfway up them to get the chimney stacks down, and then just went down again and forgot about it. It wasn't worth my vertigo.
Do you have any idea how long that house was empty before you moved in? Did it feel like it had been lived in before?
It did feel like it had been lived in before. But no, I hadn't got... I think we were so wrapped up in this move, you know, that it just seemed like how it was. I didn't really, you know, there was bits of wallpaper that we needed to paint over, but, you know, it was a time of looking forward, and I just didn't really have time to kind of speculate about its past. And throughout my stay there, I think because I was so comfortable with it, and, you know, I think everyone who lived there liked the house. You know, because I know people who've gone on and lived in other houses, and you know, there's a very much a nostalgia about that house. You know, there was some bizarre times for sure, but you know, most of the people liked it and didn't feel that there was some sort of oppressive history, that people just owned it straight away. As you know, this is my room, this is where I live. You know, these are my flatmates. Da, da, da.
And so, like, when you painted it, did you paint it the ubiquitous white?
No, the ubiquitous magnolia, actually. I think we did we mixed magnolia with white to make, you know, magnolia slightly more palatable. The studios, I think, were painted white. And the rest of the house was painted pretty much magnolia. I think we did something slightly different with the bathroom because we had some red paint that we mixed with white, so it was a very off pink white thing, and did some checkered stuff on the tile, so that was our kind of feature room in a way. But everything else was just slapped on. The big effort was actually sanding the floors, which, as you know, is a bit of a nightmare and takes quite a long time to do, although when you just slap the varnish off it, it was an achievement. But you find out who's good at what, because Kath ended up being really good at plastering and I was completely crap at it.
Wow.
I know, yeah. So I remember once I felt really bad because I had this really bad... when I was young, I used to have lots of colds. So I had a cold, you know, as we were in the middle of moving, but still in Hackney. So she'd plod off there of an evening, you know, and be slapping plaster on and stuff like that, and then come back. And
so really, you just... of work, because you're talking about sanding your floors and plastering and then fixing all those fireplaces. Have you like any recollection of how long all that preparation work took?
Really? Yeah, but I think we moved in towards the end of summer, and I think, you know, we set around Christmas, said enough is enough, this is just the way it's going to be. Yeah, it was a kind of summer move, I remember that, because that was obviously a good thing.
So you spent about 3 months doing everything.
There was dry rot as well, certainly in the outside loo, and that had to be dealt with, so that was a pain. So there was quite a lot of stuff, not as much as some, but, you know, a substantial amount kept you occupied.
So you've already mentioned that you had a lodger and that you'd done your sums, and, you know, because your earnings were quite low, were you actually working or were you unemployed at the time, and how did you finance yourself, really?
Well, I'd done a teacher training, and then this was before moving in, but realised soon after finishing... Well, I realised it about 2-3 weeks into teacher training. I didn't want to teach in schools. It was crowd control, and staff rooms gave me the willies. But I did, after a year on the dole, following that teacher training, and I think I spent... dole most of the time in Hackney. That's why I was living in Hackney. I started getting various part-time jobs teaching outreach, special needs. A friend of mine met someone in a petrol station, and, you know, these accidents, friends of friend type jobs. So I started getting a little bit of money here and there, but it was just, you know, 2 hours a week in a hospital here and 2 hours a week, you know, with some really... kids who, you know, just couldn't stay in school, got them to do murals, that sort of thing. So that was bits of work. And Kath got some bar jobs, but again, really low pay. But what it did mean is for most of the week, we were both in our studios. Mm-hmm. So it was odd having the lodger, because, and I've forgotten her name now. it might come back to me. She was like off out socializing and all. As she was going out, you know, we'd be going out to get the bottle of cider on a Friday night, which that'll be our Friday night in. And there was a tube line at the bottom of the garden. And sometimes I'd watch that at night as I was listening to the Friday play on Radio 4, or waking up and thinking, yeah, these people actually travel into town and stuff like that. Sometimes the only time we travel into town was to take a artwork to an exhibition point, the Royal Academy or some other, you know, so it was very, you know, although we had a lodge, it was still very minimal living. Very minimal, you know. We both enjoyed cooking, so that was fine. But as for social life, we just stayed in nearly all the time. You know, my brother, who was around and living in Colchester at the time, would come up every other weekend, help us with the decoration. And, you know, and only then would we go out for a meal, you know, when there was someone around, we'd take out for a meal because they helped us with some DIY or stuff like that. But although, you know, that money was tight, that, you know, I enjoyed it. It was a good time.
Yeah, and when you say about socialising, did you ever go to the North Coast?
Well, not for the first few years, actually. I think, you know, the pubs we went to in the first couple of years, because it was Philibrook Road, I don't know, we used to go to the North Star quite a lot, and the Crown. The Crown's called something ridiculous now. And the Alfred Hitchcock as well. Because we'd go for walks on the heath and then just have the one drink on the way back, and that was a way of padding out an evening and avoiding spending 3 hours worth behind the bar. So it wasn't till later, actually, that I started going down the North Coast on a regular basis.
When you went to the North Star in the other parts, were there artists in there from the Philibrook Road end? Or
no, I mean, I didn't. I think for the first year, because money was tight and Kath was shy and, you know, I had other things and other bits of social life outside of Leytonstone, so I didn't really mix with artists that much. Just the first 2 years or so, you know, we very much kept ourselves to ourselves and had friends, but they were outside of Leytonstone. So we had bikes and used to cycle in to meet friends in Hackney and stuff like that. And just a few people to say hello to and stuff. And so when we went out to the North Star and the Crown, yeah, it tended not to be with artists. We became friends with our next door neighbours, and they were Quadrant Housing Association. So if we went for a drink, it was usually with them. She worked in newspapers, and he didn't work. And that was upstairs and downstairs, Carrie or something. She worked in media, I think. And it changed, but we always, you know, there was that we knew those neighbours, but not so much the artists. So it was later, after me and Kath split up, she moved out, and then suddenly I started getting involved in the whole campaign, and that's when I got to know a lot more artists.
And what year was that?
It was, I think it was 89, I think so, yeah.
So that was really 2 years later from when you moved in?
Three, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, but the dates are very hazy. But it was the year when everything started happening. We used to call it the Summer of Love, but, you know, it was like that in Philibrook Road, because lots of people started squatting places and we started helping them, and everyone became friendly with everyone else and knew everyone else's business and was popping out of each other's doors. And it suddenly became this, you know, instead of, you know, isolated or pockets of, you know, these group of people know each other and these group of people know each other, but they don't mix. And suddenly everyone started mixing, and it was a big explosion, I think.
That's interesting. So when you moved in 87, or it might have even been 86,
yeah.
Because I had that problem, and I moved in sooner than I thought, like a year before. But did you know any of the artists down Philibrook Road, the other artists? Were you, like, even if you didn't mix with them, were you aware of who they were?
I knew there were artists around, yeah. Yeah, it's funny. It's when you start talking about this, it starts to come back, and the whole sequence of events starts to come back. Because the thing I've forgotten, and you know, this quote that you showed me, this whole latent artist group thing was something that happened before this explosion that I told you about. So, yeah, it was through that and the first latent artist group exhibition, which was in 1987. Maybe I moved in 85. It's just all that. Yeah, so I was involved that pretty much from the beginning, and I haven't got a clue how I got involved in it. I remember John Campbell Pye, but then anyone who's ever met him will not forget him.
I did see the catalogue from 89 that I was involved in, and you and Kath were both in that.
Yeah, but was that the one that was at Chisenhale?
No, that was the one in the houses linked with the Whitechapel. I think it was the first one linked with Whitechapel, but there had been previous shows before. So do you think it was likely that you showed before?
I showed in the first latent artist group exhibition. I became the deputy organiser, John Campbell Pye's sidekick. I remember that. There he is.
Can rake around for a year for that one. So if the one I was in was 89.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the catalogue. We can come back to it, because I might well have the catalogue in my desk, actually. I've got lots of documents here, so we can come back to that. But it may be earlier, but the first one involved one of the big exhibitions at the Chisenhale space, really. You know, it's really nicely set up exhibition, and also at the Acme Gallery in Bonner Road. So that was the big thing there. Yeah, and that was an interesting time, and it brought a lot of people together. But in the subsequent years, various disagreements occurred over this and that, and it kind of splintered, you know, as groups do. This is just what happens, I think. I think it was about 3 years it lasted, actually.
Now, when you did the Chisenhale show, what kind of state was the Chisenhale Gallery in? Because I know it's kind of been reconfigured over the years. Was it when it was a completely open space?
Yeah.
Because now it's divided with the education room and that corridor and so forth, was it?
If I remember, yeah, you walked in the door and there was some sort of office on the left, and then you walked down a slope, didn't you? And then there was that huge space. That's what I remember, anyway.
And what was the work that was in there? Can you remember who was in the show?
I can, because this is one of the things that led to disagreements, because it was odd. I mean, sexual politics were much more overt in those days, I remember, and it was the thing that the men were producing the larger works and the women were producing the smaller works. So, and it's a valid argument when you look back at it, because the smaller works would have less space, you know. And one argument, Julia, someone who, she was from Yorkshire, do you know Julie?
So Julie Barton.
Yeah. She argued that the smaller works should have as much space around them as the bigger works. But what happened in that first exhibition, because everything was chaotic towards the end and the hang was probably undemocratic and done in a rush, but it wasn't a conscious thing, it was just da-da-da-da. That a lot of the smaller works in Bonner Road were hung together and quite close together, so that in Chisenhale, I had a big piece in. Julian Perry had a big piece in. John Campbell Pye had a big piece in. William Stock had a big piece in. And those, I think, were the four biggest pieces that I can remember anyway. Jenny had a big piece that was a floor piece, a sculptural piece.
Do you remember her name?
Jenny and Ian, anyway, she lived in Grove Green Road, yeah. I remember that being a big piece, and there are probably other big pieces as well. Those are the ones that immediately struck my mind. I think Kath had a big piece as well, a reasonable sized piece. Can't remember where that was, but I think that was also in. That was about the time she did a piece de resistance, which she sold to Brian Sewell on the first day of the Royal Academy Summer Show. And that was a beautiful big piece of image of Hackney Wick as some sort of, he called it a celestial paradise, as he would, yeah. So that's my recollection as of this moment anyway. But I remember it being a good show with lots of good quality work.
So was it kind of painting and sculpture or completely mixed? How would you kind of describe
it? Yeah, well, I mean, looking back on it, of course, there was much less time-based and installation work there. Yeah. So it was all painting and sculpture. There may have been some photography, but it is not something specific that I can recall at this moment. There was a lot of painting in different styles, for sure, because Julian's work was very figurative, you know, scenes of tube trains, chiaroscuresque, if that's the right word, echoes of Constable, etc. Nice paintings. And my work was very figurative at that time, narrative pictures. The one in the Chisenhale was this. I did a series of paintings on holiday, and there was this one image of a Spanish white town, these small towns, white wall painted towns on hills in Spain, and it was a kind of aerial view looking down on this rather grumpy looking matriarch figure in the back garden of her small house with a lemon or lime tree next to her and various bits of life going on all around. Yeah, looking back, that was, I think, one of my most successful pieces at the time. So it was nice that that was in the show, and yeah, I thought it looked great.
Did you manage to get holidays when you were there? Was that something you drew from life? Or?
No, yeah. Again, economy holidays, I remember saving up for 3 months in advance, and we just really cheap holidays. There was the one, that holiday, I suppose, that was a holiday in Spain. Yeah, but a lot of my paintings I would do based on holiday experience. I just like that idea that, you know, for 2 weeks you kind of see things in a much fresher way than usually, and notice things that would otherwise just, you know, be taken for granted. So we went on some family holidays as well, because I'd always get invited by my brother and my mother to go with them to some cottage somewhere, and once went to Italy and stuff, so that was cheaper, of course.
And then what, tell me about your other work, because you did all that work down in Wapping, didn't you, which was in the 1989 catalogue.
Yes, well, the other aspect of my narrative painting at that time, I used to work through various themes. I had a footballer's thing, because I've always been an avid Liverpool supporter, and the last year of college, and it continued for about 4 or 5 years afterwards. I'd be very interested in painting kind of Renaissance style football type paintings where the ball was lost in some cloud and footballers were like angels arising up into the. And then the holiday pictures were another thing, and also I was very involved in politics at that time. I wasn't a member of a political party, but both my brother and my mother belonged to the Socialist Workers' Party, and the Hackney SWP tried to court me a number of times, but I don't think I was disciplined enough. But I would be involved in a lot of disputes, and I was part of a mural painting scheme in Bethnal Green Hospital. And so I helped unionise the workforce and fight for better pay and conditions and stuff like that. And got involved very much in the miners' strike, and that was 84, 85, wasn't it? Which is interesting. Yeah, no, we've got to move the date that we moved into Leytonstone back to 1985, I think. Because I was definitely in Leytonstone when that was happening.
Right.
Okay, it was just on that cusp, I think. We actually moved, must have been in the summer of 84, because the miners' strike was definitely 84, 85. So that gives us much more time to have, you know, the three Leighton artist group exhibitions. And then by 89, when me and Kath had split up, the whole M11 protesting was starting to pick up and I got involved in that. So, yeah, around 88, 89, I was very much involved in the Wapping dispute. And produced a whole series of paintings, as did Kath. We both worked together on that and we went down to the picket line, usually on Saturday nights. It's not as if we took our easels and stuff, but we just got involved in the demonstrations and ran away from horses and then went the pub afterwards. And it was a scary time, actually.
So when you were in the thick of it, I mean, and those paintings really do show that. Did you work from photographs? I mean, how did you get that together? Did you do sketches on site? Surely not.
No. I took a tiny sketchbook with me. At that time, I was doing a lot of life drawing. We both were. And so I'd take my sketchbook down and almost do these kind of abstract, almost compositional drawings on the way back on the train or something like that, or on the tube, just to get a sense of movement, you know. Bit like, you know, those abstract pictures of armies, you know, advancing and they're retreating, and various roads have intersections and stuff. And then from that and newspaper images, you know, that I perhaps use as details and things like that, I would then start to build up a composition, you know, over a period of time, and the compositions would change and change. And some of the paintings I did take 2-3 years over, really.
And how many did you do in that series? Can you remember?
Lots, about 15, 20, I think. Big pieces. I mean, one piece, because I was involved in an organisation, Red Wedge, did you remember that? Yeah. It was trying to get another Labour government in. Well, you know, there's more famous people like Billy Bragg and things. But the artist section, although well, not composed of famous artists, was quite active. And we had an exhibition, big exhibition. So I exhibited the biggest piece from the Wapping series, and that was probably about, I remember it being about 108 inches wide, so that's 9 foot, I think, something like that. So, and other big pieces as well.
So that was the width for the
height. Yeah, that was the width, yeah. That was the widest. So I did a whole series of, you know, I think probably about 7 or 8 really big pieces and then some smaller pieces.
So they would, that's almost like room size wall,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Totally.
Domestic room size.
Yeah, well, with my biggest piece, the problem was I tried to sell it to Nalgo, and then they took the measurements and then came back to me saying, no, we haven't got a wall big enough. I think it was just an excuse. Aesthetic heathens.
So how many of these big pieces did you say you did?
There were two really big pieces around that 9 foot size, and then about 4 or 5 that were, I think, about 4 or 5 foot wide by about 5 by 3 foot, that sort of thing. So a lot of stuff. You know, I really worked that theme. And then afterwards I did a series on the poll tax as well, because I was there, you know, during the poll tax riot in Trafalgar Square and did a series. But that wasn't as successful. I don't know why. I think there were various problems with my art and the way I was painting that were kind of subsumed while I was doing the Wapping dispute. Not necessarily because it was a more important dispute, but I think it was a protracted dispute. So like the poll tax thing, it was just the one afternoon, wasn't it? So you had to paint pictures from just that one hour, you know, that's when it really flared up, that 1 hour. I remember it quite vividly. But with the Wapping dispute, it was, you know, it was over a year. So you go back week in, week out. So the ideas would have a chance to mull around and ferment and stuff like that. Yeah.
And what happened to that work? I mean, did you document it? Have you still got it? You know,
where... Yeah, I've got images of it. One I sold... and got a gallery on the back of it, which was nice. But after the selling of that work, it didn't really do much for me.
Who did you sell it to?
It was a private buyer, and I've forgotten his name. And he was an eccentric and interesting chap. He used to come to the open studios and just bend my ear back, and lots of other people would be coming in, and I wouldn't be able to get away. And he had a good collection of art. I went round to his place once. He had some, well, it was seen as good at that time, Howsons and the whole Scottish school, Ken Curry, that sort of thing.
Oh, right, that figures, because that work fits neatly into that context, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he showed some of my work to, I think there was a key gallery in Covent Garden that was dealing with Scottish artists, and... Yeah, he didn't quite like my work, thought I needed to do more of it or whatever. But yeah, that was a possibility of an opening that never happened. You know, all artists have
and
that story.
There was another gallery that you got involved with on the back of that work.
There was a Yanis Avison gallery in Camden, and he later went on to do the European shows, but it was always a kind of minor kind of exhibitor. But I was involved with him, and there was also a gallery in Portobello that dealt with my work as well. But this was at the end of the 80s, and you must remember when it was actually quite easy to get galleries involved in your and interested in your work. And there was a flourishing art market, especially perhaps for that my sort of work, which was figurative, quirky, narrative, whatever, yeah?
Because I remember the same thing happening in New York around 89. And a lot of the galleries that were there the year before, 88, were non-existent by 89.
Yeah.
About that time.
Do you remember what year Black Wednesday was? Do you remember that crash? It was a normal... I think it was something to do with the pound against the euro. I don't know. But it was seen as a kind of significant point in the demise of the Conservative government. And I remember having a private view on that evening, and there was a strange atmosphere because everyone realised that financially this whole bubble that we'd been living under in the 80s and the Thatcher, you know, especially for the yuppies, was going to burst. And especially in Portobello Road, you know, within a year, half the galleries closed. You know, especially the kind of more fragile ones to which, you know, I was belonging to one of them. The Blenheim Gallery, I think, run by someone called Mary McGowan, who I hear is still involved in art.
Can you spell that?
The Blenheim, as in Blenheim Palace, yeah. And then there was the Tabernacle Art Centre, which is still going strong, and I exhibited there as well in various shows. But a lot of people were doing that journey on the Central Line from Leytonstone to Portobello because of the thriving art market that was there at the time. You know, you'd meet people on the tube with their canvases that they were taking to galleries and stuff like that. That was interesting. Yeah.
And tell me a bit more about the Leighton Artists Group. Like, how many people were sort of the core people actually involved in the organisation of that?
Yeah. First year, it was very much John Campbell Pye, and he did it, yeah, and in a slightly draconian. And I always remember his notices to artists. He'd send round these circulars, and they used to be at four short paragraphs, and, you know, every other sentence would be in bold. You will hand your work in by this date, you know, rather than, would you mind doing this, and that sort of thing. So it very definitely had a flavour. And then afterwards, as other people... So he was, the first year, he was definitely in charge, and I was helping. And then the second year, I think it became more democratic. So I remember Julia Barton actually being much more involved in the second and third. I just took a back seat, I think, after that first year. And the other people took over and organised it slightly differently. So I remember, and Jenny and Ian were involved as well. Again, I can't remember their names. I'm not sure about, I can't remember. But that wasn't the first organisation, was it? Because the first one was the one that Mark Sowden and Sheila were involved. Art East, yeah.
Yeah, can you remember anything about Art?
Well, I remember, because I used to feel quite... There were occasionally private views, certainly during the first couple of years when I was living there. And like me and Kath would go along and stand in this room with lots of artists who seemed to know each other. And, you know, a couple would say hello. And I used to get a kind of cold sweat. I used to get terrified of private views. Not now, but it took me a hell of a long time as well. Because when we were living in Hackney, Jock McFadden was our landlord. So he'd say, oh, come along to our private views. And he'd say, ah, Steve, Kath, hi, you know, have a drink. This is so-and-so. And then after 5 minutes, that was it. We wouldn't talk to... So he'd just sit there, still stand there, and then run away after about 10 minutes. Nightmare. So I think I've always had that. So I remember going to the Art East things in that, what is it, the showroom on Leytonstone High Road a couple of times. I got talking to Sheila occasionally, just for a couple of minutes, and that was very nice. But I got that sense early on that there was a club and I wasn't part of it.
And did you ever feel at any point that you did become part of that club?
Well, I think with the Leytonstone Artists Group, yeah, we were part of that club. Yeah, it's just there was a new club formed in which we were a part of, yeah. But I think there were other people, I mean, you'll have to ask them, but I think there were other people in the area whose social life was very much around artists and, you know, most of their friends were artists, etc., etc. They'd go much more private, and I always had this slight allergy to private views. So even though, you know, there was the Leighton Artist Group and this and that, I would not go to as many private views, and usually, more friends than not were non-artists, and it's still the case today, I think. Just, you know, just the way it was. I'd hardly ever go to City Racing, for example, even though Sheila was, I was, you know, we were flatmates at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in a way, you did actually sort of become part of Art East in that you lived in the same house as Sheila Whittaker. Is that who you mean when you say Sheila?
Yeah. Well, it was funny because I think she was kind of, I can't remember, but anyway, she, for one reason or another, I think it was because of the Northcote and stuff like that. And I knew a lot more people after that summer where the protests really started. So, you know, when a room in a house becomes empty, people hear about it quite quickly. Yeah.
What summer were you talking about here?
Well, I think we're coming back to this summer, and it was after me and Kath had split up, and I think it was 89, but it could have been 90, when there was the big festival at the Northcote, and also on not Colville Road, Claremont Road Festival. Do you remember that festival?
No.
Yeah, it was a great festival.
I think it might be 1990,
actually. Yeah, could have been. So let's say 1990. Yeah, so that was when I got to know people. And at that time, obviously with Kath moving out, I started having lodgers, yeah, that share the rent and stuff like that. And various people move in and out. And one of them, because I had about succession of different people living there, was Sheila. And I think she was one of the later ones. So when I eventually moved out of Philibrook Road, that must have been, again, I'm hazy, but perhaps 93. Yeah, perhaps 93. Yeah, there was me, her, and Ruth. We were the last trio to live in that house. But before Ruth and Sheila, you know, I think there was about five or six people had lived in there. Yeah.
Okay. So, like, going back to your work, you spoke a bit about artists. I'm just thinking the open studios. Like, for example, how did you set up your work in your house?
Yeah, open studios, yeah, because that was, I think that, if I remember, that would be the second year of Leighton Artist Group, the open studios kicked in. So we're probably talking about, what, 87, 88, something like that. And I think there were 2-3 years when I was, and so basically you just tidy up your studio and hang some pictures on the wall.
Was there a particular room in your house you might use, or did you have it integrated throughout the house, or how did people kind of receive the work in the space?
I think, you know, if I remember, me and Kath had one work each in the corridors leading to our studios, but then the bulk of our work would either be stacked on a wall that people could flick through, but we'd have, you know, 2-3 pieces hanging on the wall.
So you kind of kept it really in your studio space, and so your private space was separate.
Yeah, totally.
So you arranged it. And were there any other galleries around that you got involved with? Like, you did get involved in the Whitechapel Art Gallery, because you were, that quote is in the 1990 Whitechapel Open Catalogue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so is that kind of, because you spoke about the studios, I mean, I just wondered if you would like to read that.
Yeah, sure. I think, as I've said, it sounds a bit too articulate for me, but I'm sure there are a few words that come from my mouth. So I'm supposed to have said sometime in the 1980s, since 1987, Leighton Artists Group have been opening their studios to the public. But unlike most other open studios, ours are in the houses we live in a community of adjacent streets threatened with demolition by the planned M11 road extension. We belong to a larger local culture united against a common threat. And out of this has come a huge diversity of local activity, community meetings, demonstrations, street parties, cabarets and workshops. Here artists are not isolated but actually belong. It's an exciting place to live and work.
So that's interesting, because that was written in 1990, and that's the point when you said things started to change as well. I mean, you mentioned artists, which was a bit earlier, and going to the openings. Was there a point when you did get involved in Art East, or did that that artist, when did that fold up?
I don't know.
And then that was, and then it sounds like the open studios came in after the demise of Art East.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, reading that back, it now sounds like me. It doesn't sound like me when I read it, It definitely does. There's that. I think it's also odd, you know, sometimes like 15 years on, because you think you've learned, you know, in the journey, you kind of have this image, oh, I must have not known anything 15 years ago. And, you know, that sense of progress. So that sounds about right. And if I remember, there was this sense that Art East was the pioneer arts organisation. And there was some sort of overlap with Leighton Artist Group, but then Leighton Artist Group became, you know, the thing that kind of organised the open studios, if I remember. You know, and by then I think, you know, both John Campbell Pye and myself had taken a back seat, and there was an organisational group, and, you know, everyone pretty much knew what to do after a year or two. It seemed to work reasonably well, and the maps were produced, and it was tied in, as you say, with the Whitechapel. And
I remember when I was involved in 89, somebody, an artist, just told me about it and just said, take your photograph and statement for the catalogue down to Julia. And that was it. And we had a chat, and then basically it was up to you, and had the dates and so forth. So it was quite autonomous in a way.
Yeah.
People just did it themselves, and that was quite nice, actually.
Mm.
So you talk about, there's quite a lot of other stuff going on, like you mentioned the workshops you were involved in. Were a lot of them around East London, or where were they located?
Yeah, I was employed by Tower Hamlets Institute and got a lot of work through them. Well, not a lot, but there was a point, probably around that time, 88, 89, when I was doing quite a lot of work for Tower Hamlets Institute. It's interesting because the job I've got now in this building is as a kind of tutor organiser. And back then in 89, I was appointed, I don't know how many days a week, but I think it was 1 or 2 days a week, to be a kind of tutor organiser as well, where I would go round and observe tutors teaching and support it and report to a manager, and we'd, you know, either close classes or support them. But then it was a different climate for adult education then, you know. We'd encourage students, tutors, to, you know, make sure that there were so many people on the register, even though there weren't that many people there. And it was very supportive because, you know, there are a lot of really important groups when there's only 4 or 5 people turning up, especially in those days. You know, the amount of, you know, the local authority funding for, say, music groups in Brick Lane and places like that, and supporting, you know, community Asian music collectives and stuff like that. And that was interesting. And at the same time, we'd have classes in old people's home where there's 100 old people and they'd all be white, you know. And so there was that odd mix of, you know, what Tower Hamlets is like. It's a strange, strange politically, a strange area. So that I was employed there, and I think that was the first time I actually got a bit of money. But that was an odd job. So, yeah, Tower Hamlets and working around Bromley by Bow and stuff like that.
It sounds like you was doing quite a lot of different kinds of workshops.
Yeah. Well, it's not really workshops, classes, yeah?
So workshops were different. What sort of things would you teach?
Well, I think my most... I teach life drawing. I worked a lot in a community centre in Bromley by Bow. And art classes, general art classes. And I teach as well. I did a lot of work for a hospital that's now closed, St Andrew's Hospital in Bromley by Bow as well.
And what did you do, say, at the hospital?
Well, I started off teaching on geriatric ward, and that was just basically to keep people occupied while, you know, nurses could take a break, because it's hard.
So was she working like one-to-one, or...?
No, at the time I was friends with someone called Robin. Sorry, I'm giving all these names. Robin and Linda, who used to live in Dyers Hall Road, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And he was an art therapist, so we'd have discussions, but my work was nothing like art therapy. In the geriatric ward, it's go in and get as many people as possible to splash some paint on a piece of paper, chat to them, listen to their stories, you know, be nice. And then later I got to working in a stroke unit, which is a bit better, because I got to start working with speech therapists and art therapists and physiotherapists. And they actually gave me stuff to do and said, strokes are something that you can help with art. You know, you can get them to try and draw a clock that's not a semicircle, because of the nature of the stroke. Get them to notice if a patient paints on one side of a piece of paper and encourage them to look at the blank side that they keep ignoring. So I felt, you know, that of all the outreach things, and it's interesting because again in my job I have tutors working outreach, so I realise it's quite frontline type stuff. You know, that was the one that seemed most rewarding. So yeah, 2 hours a week for 20 weeks or 30 weeks of the year. You know, often paid at the end of the course, you know, or you could get paid halfway through. So that sort of thing. So a bit better than workshops in that sense. It's a more regular income. And I don't think I ever did workshops. I know a lot of people did go and get money to do workshops in schools and stuff like this, but this was much more standard adult teaching, traditional adult teaching.
Do you think that sort of work then differs from what it is now? Or...
Well, I think there's less of it now. Not wanting to blow our trumpet, but I think the Workers' Education Association, more than other organisations, adult education institutes, still provides art history classes and drawing classes without accreditation. And that was the bog standard then. I know that a lot of other institutes have, you know, had to go down the accredited route in order to keep the funding coming in. But yeah, there seemed to be more work then.
And do you think, I don't know, I mean, was there a lot of freedom? More freedom then, do you think? Or just more opportunities?
What do you mean by freedom?
Freedom within the practice, you know.
Freedom.
As to what you could do. Like, could you, how did they set it up? Would you sort of come up with an idea? Say, if you worked in the hospital and...
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, adult education's a nightmare now compared to how it was then, for sure. The amount of paperwork nowadays is appalling. And then people were interested, you know, there's the kind of philosophy, look, you know, just go and teach, you know, we trust you that you're going to teach and students are going to have benefit. There's going to be minimal checks on it, but basically the thing is just, you know, just go out and teach. And so, you know, there was that sense of trust between organisations and the tutors that were in their employ. It's completely gone now because of the government.
And so you said about the open studios. Can you say anything more about those? I mean, did you actually go round the other houses when the studios were open? Did you get a chance to do that, or were you totally vigilating your own work? Or
yeah, that's a good point, time? Actually. Good point.
Because it was like several weekends.
Yeah. No, just one weekend.
Okay.
Yeah, it was just one weekend of the year. It was a Saturday and a Sunday. I think, you know, I remember something like 10 till 7 or 10 till 8, I can't remember the times. But yeah, that I remember that being the problem. And I don't know whether you find any other people to, but I kind of remember that on the Sunday night, the people would move from studio to studio. You know, as things started to close up on the Sunday night, people, you know, there'd be kind of little party and people would move from one studio to another, and that was quite nice. But a lot of time people were so knackered by then anyway, because it's tiring, you know. But we got punters coming through the door, which is good, it's well organised.
What was the audience? I mean, say a little bit more about the audience that came.
Mixture of people. It'd be a mixture of artists from other groups. Like every artist in the open studio had friends who were artists who would come and see that artist's work and also do the walk. Yeah. So you can imagine if there were a lot of artists involved, that would multiply. So, you know, I'm a friend of so-and-so, so, oh, yeah. And then there'd be local people because it was advertised locally. And then there'd be, you know, friends of yours that weren't artists that would also do the walk as well. So I think that there was that quality to it. And occasionally, you know, buyers and the odd gallery owner would come round as well.
Because there were the later ones in 89 were advertised with the Whitechapel as part of the whole of not just... Well, we were linked up with the East End.
Yeah.
Although Leighton was a bit off the track in the sense we were part of East London.
Yeah.
But we were then linked up. So did you notice any other artists from, say, Whitechapel or Stepney or coming down? Or do you think it was more like once did Leightonstone? Or...
I don't know, I think... Yeah, very vague memory. But I think people from the East End, you know, say from Whitechapel. I remember a couple of people coming down. You know, because you didn't talk to everyone who came in. You know, some people did want to talk, and some people didn't. So it's difficult to say, really.
Okay.
Yeah, I did get the sense that it wasn't just Leighton and Leightonstone that was visiting this Urban Studios. Mm-hmm. That it was a wider audience, for sure.
To really sort of the point where you said things started to change in your street and the area where lots of people started to squat, and I think that was 1990 or 89 straight 1990.
Let's call it 1990, so
can you talk a bit about that?
I remember it being a spring thing, and someone who became a close friend of mine, Clodagh O'Donnell, knocked on the door once saying, was it about the Labour Party? Or was it... She was active anyway, politically, in some local thing. And then from that, I became friends with her. And, it just started to spiral, I think. And I'm not sure. I knew quite a lot of people in Leighton, in Philibrook Road, a lot of non-artists as well. Pretty much the whole of Philibrook Road, actually.
So you'd become a real socialite.
Yeah, totally. People used to be annoyed with me walking down the street because I'd always have someone to... Well, not annoyed, but there'd be the joke. And I think it was the same for a lot of people, yeah?
It took you a long time to get from one end of the street to the next.
And that was nice. I sometimes used to feel self-conscious because I would say, oh, hi, how are you? And sometimes people just went, oh, hi, Steve, bye, yeah? Like, no, what's happening? But it was nice, and I enjoyed that sort of interaction, actually. I always liked that sense of community there. You'd know people on a quite superficial level in some ways, but I was quite happy just having a smaller circle of close friends, but just to have no people. But that happened quite quickly, and all sorts of other people that were non-artists started to get involved. There was a guy called Gary who always wore a flat cap. I don't really remember him, and he got involved quite quickly. And someone called Julia who lived in Dyers Hall Road. Yeah, lots of people who were not part of Leighton Artist Group, but just part of the local community. And I think that bond between non-artists and artists really started to gel at that time.
Working in different disciplines would suddenly start doing artwork and then opening studios, or you're talking more of a social engagement?
Yeah, I'm talking more of a political engagement, actually.
Right.
Because I remember the first thing that happened was the public inquiries of whenever, 80, late 80s. When the spectre of this road first really started to rear its head. And then people started to get to know each other via these public inquiries and various characters certainly did a lot more work than others. And but you start to talk to people very much then. And, people started to organise meetings. And then on top of that, as the public inquiry started becoming prominent, people who you started to know that people who were moving out, because there was always people moving in and out, but you'd know that then the Department of Transport would trash the house, and there was evidence of it. So the local community would go in, find out who was moving out, and then go in before the Department of Transport had a chance to do it and get someone else in. And we never had to look for anyone, because there was this strange word of mouth that people, dispossessed from Colombia, or lots of Australians as well who were travelling the world, would just start to gravitate towards Leightonstone because they heard about it through word of mouth that there were spaces. So there was one, I think, in 91 Philibrook Road, which is full of Australians. And that was great. And then there was a house near us, I think it was 153, that was full of Colombians, and that was a family, actually, a really sweet family. So you get this, it became like a microcosm of the world. It's fantastic.
Yes, because when you first moved there, How did it feel in terms of, you know, the different cultural backgrounds of the people located there?
I had this image almost like of a checkerboard, you know, because the checkerboard, you get black, white. It's like artist, non-artist, you know, and that kind of clear division, you know, as you go up and down the road, an artist lives there, and in between are people that don't think they're artists or what they do, yeah.
And why do you think you thought like that?
Yeah, because there's no interaction between the two groups, yeah.
I mean, is it because there were so many artists there?
Yeah, artists were about half of the total population, I think. Probably a little under, actually. But they were the half that you knew more of, so it's being bigger. Mm. Yeah. But, you know, in hindsight, there was Acme, and then there was Quadrant. And I think in Philibrook Road, there were as many Quadrant houses as Acme houses. And then there was some people who owned their properties, like the Connollys next door to me, and there was another family next door to John Bissett, I think number 151 or something like that. Yeah, so a few people who owned the houses as well.
Were there any other housing associations that you can remember?
Was it Solon? Does that ring a bell? Yeah, I can't exactly remember, but certainly in Philibrook, Quadrant and Acme were the big two. Maybe a couple of Solon, I don't know, but those were the big two. Mm. Knew quite a lot of people who were Quadrant. My neighbours were, and lots of people either side. A lot of young people, like same age as us, but you know, they'd been to the LSC or done different degrees, and then just worked their way into Short Life.
So LSC.
London School of Economics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you think there were a high number of
ex-students
there?
Yeah. Yeah.
They the main people that were squatting at that time?
No. So the students and the ex-students, and we can include Acme artists because they're pretty much all ex-students, were in the two big housing associations, Acme and Quadrant. And then the squatters would tend not necessarily to be... different, yeah. Sometimes, as I say, families, you know, just needed housing. The Australians, some of them were students, just, you know, others just wanted to travel the world on a shoestring, really. Some were musicians. Mm-hmm. We ended up playing, me and sort of the band I was in, we played with some of the musicians and stuff, and they got involved in the festival for sure. Everyone got involved, and it was a community. Well, let's say 1990, yeah? Mm-hmm. Or was it 1991? I might have posters on that, I don't know. Yeah. Say 1990-91. But it was as the whole road protest built up ahead of steam, and this was before the complete transformation of Coville Road into tree huts and stuff like that. So in a sense, you could call it the first wave of protest. The second wave of protest with the thing that really picked up and got the national news was later, and I was not really a part of as much, for sure. You know, by that time, I'd started to go back to college again and stuff and had to withdraw and moved out of Philibrook into Grove Green Road by then. But during the inquiry and the protests against the inquiry built up ahead of steam, and you know, there was a festival committee that met in the North Coat and met in people's houses, and this festival, which is a great festival, took place one summer, I think it was June, and got all sorts of people involved. There was a local councillor, Hugh Morgan Thomas, I think his name was. He was very involved in the festival. Lots of people, pretty much everyone, yeah.
Was the festival centred around the Noem 11 campaign?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And there was a woman who ran the Northcote at the time, and she was very sympathetic. So she let us use the back of the Northcote, and there was a stage there. It was a big, organised event, you know. A lot of people put a lot of work into it. And there was a bouncy castle... in Claremont Road. I think it was called the Claremont Road Festival. I don't know, but whatever. But yeah, lots of things. And by then, you know, the squatting had really picked up, and I think squatting takes place very much through word of mouth. So all sorts of different people came in, and just got to know lots of people. It's great.
And so also, I mean, if it was part of the No M11 campaign, were there any sort of T-shirts and flyers and badges and stuff that went with that?
There was a poster. It was a really nice poster, and I can't remember who did it. And I think I still have a copy. I think there might have been T-shirts as well. Can't remember. Yeah, because I was in a band at the time, so I was playing the gig, along with a couple of other bands. And I was helping with the organisers, so a lot of stuff just, you know, other people did it, and I just wasn't, had my mind on other things, really. But I remember the poster and helping with that. And
so the gig was in the Northcote, and outside. Can you remember the bands?
Yeah, my band was the Mosquitoes. I think we headlined it, actually.
So it was in the street, actually?
No, it was in the backyard of the Northcote. There was another band as well. I can't remember. There were a couple of comedians. Can't remember their names either. Lucy. Do you remember someone called Lucy? She was a comedian. She did a performance. There was someone called Joe as well. This is all no good to you because it's all first names. I'm sorry. Yeah, but it was a great thing anyway. It was crowded. Yeah, because the festival in Claremont Road was during the day on the Saturday. And then everyone went to the Northcote in the evening. And then the gig was in the evening. And there's a film somewhere of it.
Okay, and
I think Ian Bourne has got the film, actually. Ask him. It's probably lost in his archive somewhere.
Yeah, what did the festival consist of, apart from the bands in the evening? What happened during the day?
Oh, bouncy castle stalls, that sort of thing. Yeah.
And where were the stalls?
They were at the bottom end of Claremont Road. You know, on that corner, the bottom end. It was all around there. And extended it halfway up as well, I think.
Did you say Claremont Road?
Yeah, yeah.
So basically they blocked the street off?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we got permission. We must have got permission to do that. It's not a thoroughfare anyway. I mean, we didn't block Grove Green Road up. Yeah, it was a very sunny summer. It's a beautiful summer. Hot. Yeah, and that was the kind of centrepiece to it. It was a great summer.
And when you mentioned the public inquiry, there were several, weren't there? Did you?
Yeah, I certainly went to the first few. They were grim affairs. Everyone knew it was a sham. You know, and history has borne that out, of course. Various politicians, you know, made big speeches and then disappeared. Some stayed. I think, you know, everyone had respect for Harry Cohen. He was, you know, a solid supporter and would often be on some of the demonstrations against the roadworks.
Who else can you remember at the public inquiry?
Well, at the public inquiry, a lot of people got very active. You know, it annoyed a lot of people. There was a lot going on at those in those times. I know Sally Barker was very much involved. And there was a chap called Richard. He was the one that was most involved. He used to live in Colville Road with his mother. Do you know
this? Richard
Layton. That's it. Yes. That's the one. So, you know, again, this mixture of artists and non-artists.
Anybody else that you can remember?
Yeah, there's a guy called Colin who, I'll never forget it, organised this group called Logical, which was an acronym for Leytonstone Opposes the Government's Insidious Corruption Against Its Locality, which was one of the great acronyms of all time, I think. But that was he. Yeah, I'm just crap at surname. Sorry. Sheila Whittaker was involved, and Pete Owen. Yeah, Clodagh O'Donnell was involved a lot as well. There was a guy called Henry something. Paris, was it? Don't know. He looked like some Maharishi, tall, bald guy with a long beard. He was involved a lot. Yeah, probably people as involved as those, but, you know, I've just forgotten.
Let's sort of think about the public inquiry for a minute. So how... They went on all day, didn't they? Over several days. You'd have a block.
Yeah. Did you go?
No, I've just seen the archive.
Okay.
The list of the names of people.
Yeah.
And in those meetings, what was the atmosphere like?
I think I didn't go to a number of the public inquiries. I don't know why. They bored me and I thought it was pointless anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just went to get wound up for sure, you know. Because I think with protests like that, you know, anger is a bit of a drug, you know. You can go wanting to get, and there's so much to get annoyed about. So, I don't know. There was there various reasons. I was more involved in the protests, you know, on the streets and stuff like that than going to the public inquiry and, you know, arguing the point. And I was involved in other things with the poll tax and stuff at the time. So I'm not a reliable witness for the inquiries. Can't remember that much about them, to be honest.
So tell me about what you was involved in. I mean, you said the campaigns on the street. What were they like?
There were various protests. I think there was a lot of protests because there was a sorting office on Philly Brook Road. So I did a number of watercolours at that time about, because, you know, it's a thing, I like doing stuff about protest. So there was often that, you know, just standing outside houses, knowing that either the bailiffs or the Department of Transport would come up, and the squatters would be inside, and we were just a mass of witnesses. So they saw us there. You know, if we weren't there, they may try and smash the door down and kick the squatters out. But with us there, and we pull the press in as well, because the various journalists had lived along the road as well, then that was the important thing to do. So I remember that being the thing that perhaps I was most involved with, you know. Quite happy to get up early in the morning and stand outside a house for an hour or so. Yeah.
And how often did that happen? Around that time?
Yeah, it happened regularly for sure. Not just in, you know, in all the roads. You know, I remember sometimes taking nails down and banging floorboards back in with other people and stuff like that. And then, you know, standing outside the house for the next few days, seeing if anyone turned up and stuff.
And how many people would stand outside the house?
Yeah, a good crowd would be 10, 15 if I remember rightly.
And would they actually block the bailiffs from coming in, or?
No, there wouldn't be any physical violence like that. So, it's this thing, if the bailiffs or the Department of Transport saw we were there, the idea was that, and I think it's right, that they would act differently than if we weren't there. So we were just there as witnesses. You know, we'd shout and people would say things and we'd chant and stuff like that. And
yeah. And would they actually get the people out?
No, they didn't.
So when they saw the crowd, they were like put off?
I think so, yeah.
So they'd just go off?
Yeah.
So that was very similar to what was happening with the poll tax, wasn't it? This idea of blocking a doorway or...
Yeah, poll tax was different because I didn't pay the poll tax and you didn't need a crowd with the poll tax. Because the trick was I could never keep my front windows open during that whole time because... The rules for poll tax bailiffs are those sorts of bailiffs, a bit like vampires, you know, you can't keep a window open, you know, but they're not allowed to open a window or jimmy it open. So, you know, we had those sash windows stuff, mm-hmm. So I put screws in it so you couldn't stick a knife up and just jimmy it open. that sort of thing. So, you know, you get bangings on the door at 7 o'clock in the morning and letters coming saying, you know, you need to pay by tomorrow or else we're going to break in. But I knew, break in and da, 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 but I knew my law or whatever by then, or bits of the law anyway, so I knew that that wasn't going to happen. But it was a scary time.
Because I didn't pay my poll tax either, but I left in 1990 and it really started hotting up there because I didn't get taken to court down at Walthamstow.
Yeah, me too.
But there was a whole crowd there.
Yeah.
So can you describe what that was like when you went to court?
Well, I think we were all briefed. I remember being briefed. And the idea was to just use as much court time as possible. Can't remember. I remember me and Paul Noble went down. We were on the same day.
Do you think it was the SWP?
No.
I remember being, I was briefed by the SWP before I went in.
Right, it might have been. I think I, because I'd had lots of friends who were political, so I think it may have been, oh, you've got, well, I think, I remember, you should go rather than not go because that wastes course time. Court time, yeah, and if you can talk for as long as possible, that's fine. But I wasn't—I didn't do very well. Spoke for about, you know, 5 minutes, and then the beak said, "You know, right, that's it, off." Yeah.
So, what did you say? Can you remember?
Well, we were given stuff to read, and I said, "You know, I can't. I've got to read this." And then I sat there reading it, and then said, "Right, come on, you know, have you got any questions?" I said, "You know, I need more time," and said, "Sorry," and that's it. So I just blustered, and I remember feeling embarrassed and flushed and nervous about it.
How was it set up? Was you on your own, or was there a crowd?
No, on my own, yeah. I remember. Yeah, we just waited all morning and then got seen, you know, around 12, 1 o'clock or something, and then got discharged. And
do you know what year that was?
No. About the same time, though.
1990.
Yeah, when was the poll tax riot? Do you remember?
I think it was around 89.
Was it? Yeah, it must have been.
I was in court, but there was a whole crowd of people. You've never seen anything like it in the dock.
Right.
And we were asked one question and we'd been briefed to say one sentence reply.
Okay.
So yours sounds much more intimidating.
Perhaps, maybe they changed their tactics. You were before me or after me, I don't know. It was all a bit of a non-event. These things usually are, yeah? You can get really nervous the night before and then, you know, 5 minutes and you're out. And I can't remember whether I paid or not, actually. I think after it got abolished... Can't remember, but yeah, I mean it was, you know, the whole thing about the M11 was. I think some people were very pessimistic about the whole protest. Oh, you know, we've lost. But I always saw things optimistically that the protest achieved a lot and, in a sense, changed policy. And the same with poll tax. You know, lots of people doing just a little thing. You know, just. Built up a head of steam, I think. So those are heady times.
Because when you got your house from ACME, you was given a time scale, and it probably was ended up being longer than you thought.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
So can you remember what the time scale was?
No, I think they were 2-year renewable contracts, weren't they? Were they? No, they were 1-year renewable contracts. Well, something like that, anyway. I remember them being renewed and the rent would go up by a small amount every year. And again, there was the argument, because there was a lot of discussion going on in those days. You know, the idea that everyone agreed on the thing to do when the road came along with the poll tax is not true. And the nice thing about the community is that things were discussed and debated. You know, there was never a consensus, but there was a discussion and debate that went on there. So some people would say, you know, we can't expect anything more than what we've got. You know, they give us a year and, you know, if we've got a bit more, that's fine. But what's the point in protesting? You know, count yourself lucky. And then the other argument would be, look, you know, that's the way it was. But we've built up a community here that's really valuable, you know, and what we want to do is to try and, you know, the best we can to preserve it. And what's going to take its place is, you know, is not good for all sorts of reasons.